victims, Kevin Lee, spoke outside the Old Bailey.
Today we feel that justice has been served upon these individuals. But each day we live with the pain created by this monster, Joanne Dennehy, and her accomplices. But unfortunately, no amount of justice will ever bring Kevin back.
Stuart Hall will go on trial in May after pleading not guilty to historical sex attacks on two girls. The 84-year-old former broadcaster has been charged with 15 counts of rape and 5 of indecent assault. Hundreds of people have lost millions of pounds to a fraud scam. 110 arrests have been made after international raids. Anna Jones reports.
Officers say the lavish lifestyles led by the fraudsters was like something out of the film The Wolf of Wall Street.
$26,000 for one dinner!
They lived off money people thought had been invested.
He got me almost, well, not hypnotised, but he sort of that way, you know, I trust him so much.
But the shares were fake.
I foolishly trusted him and I did borrow money out of my house.
Steve Head is from City of London Police.
People's lives have been devastated by this kind of crime.
At least 850 people have been conned in the UK alone.
David Cameron has spoken by phone to President Putin, telling him that Russia must respect the territorial integrity of Ukraine. The call comes as Moscow stands accused of sending armed units into Crimea. The UKIP leader Nigel Farage has rounded on people who claim he's running a party of fruitcakes. Speaking at their spring conference in Torquay, he insists UKIP are a party to be reckoned with. In his sport, the West Indies look to have salvaged a credible score in the first one-day international against England. A few minutes ago, they were 244 for 5 after 48 overs. That's the latest. I'm Chris Giles.
BCFM 93.2.
Thanks to Red and Alice for another legendary performance. If you missed it, shame on you. Because it's Friday, it's 5 o'clock, and BCFM's politics show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Conservative councillor for Clifton, Charles Lucas. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, well, the battle for Ukraine began in earnest last Friday when the Kiev Parliament building was occupied by armed men. The ruling party of the region's MPs were shot at and forced out, leaving a rump of right-wing pro-EU MPs who voted to impeach the President Yanukovych. Now, Russian troops are carrying out scheduled exercises on the Ukrainian border, and other groups of militias and armed men are popping up all over Ukraine. Martin Summers takes us to Ukraine on his weekly tour of Global Flashpoints. Also, food additives. One very good reason to check the label tonight as we look at a sweetener neurosurgeons call a poison. That's in much of our food, aspartame. And as the media battle rages quietly to explain the inexcusable, that is to mark the anniversary of the First World War, Martin Summers takes us through former BBC Newsnight economist, economics editor, Paul Mason's four-part series that could not, in his opinion, be produced in Britain today, that is, the People's First World War. Tonight, part two, The Slaughter. And to lighten things at the end of the show, it's the 20th anniversary this week of the death of Texas-born comedian Bill Hicks, who some believe might have been bumped off just as he was about to get his own network television show right across America. We celebrate his memory by hearing why he might have been such a danger to the US establishment. That's all in the second hour after 6 o'clock. Time for our fortnightly weather forecast now, and tonight lows of 1, minus 1 in fact, and some light rain. This weekend highs of 10 Celsius, a fairly cloudy weekend with some sunny spells. Heavy showers and strong winds coming in on Sunday evening. Highs of 11 Celsius, sunshine and some sporadic showers next week, and some strong winds too. Next weekend, that's the 8th and 9th of March, highs of 10 Celsius with some sunny spells. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Time to introduce this week's guest now, and that is Clifton councillor, Conservative, Charles Lucas. Hi, Charles, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Thank you very much.
First of all, Charles, are you fairly new? When did you get elected?
I was elected in May, so I've only been around 9 months, and it was a very nice surprise, to be
okay.
honest.
What got you into politics in the first place?
It's a question I'm often asked. It's... I lived in Clifton, moved into Clifton, lived there for 5 years, never heard from anybody. And so I approached the Conservative group and said, why have I never heard from you? And funnily enough, by chance, the following day, a Labour leaflet fell through my letterbox. And I thought, oh, we need to do something about this. And so I set myself a challenge of standing for the Conservatives to try and win Clifton for the Conservatives.
OK, and how did you do? I mean, you obviously are a councillor now,
well,
but did you replace a Lib Dem, or was there a former Conservative?
Well, I stood,
Conservative
stood initially and came second, and that was nearly 3 years ago now. And I stood again in May, and I would say I was fortunate. The Independents of Bristol stood, and a very strong candidate stood in Clifton, Brenda McLennan, and also Trevor Bly stood down as a Liberal Democrat, and so there was a void, and I happened to turn up at the right time and was elected.
Well, what about your background? You know, what's your profession or what do you do?
Well, born and bred in Bristol, went to school in Clifton, and lived in North Somerset as a growing as part of, you know, with my parents. Went to London, did 10 years in London in my 20s, and then came back to Bristol.
What were you doing in London?
I was in the wine trade in London.
Very nice.
It was lovely. Actually.
Anything you'd like to recommend for us at the moment?
Well,
do you still take an interest in wine? I suppose I should ask that.
I do. Yeah. Well, I was going to come on to that. When I got to Bristol, I set up my own small independent wine company as a hobby business, which still trades, albeit in a very small fashion. And I do it because I love it. And the wines of Bordeaux are a particular favourite of mine, which obviously is tactful. Bear in mind, Bristol still has very strong connections with Bordeaux.
Well, without wishing to advertise too much, if people want to have a chat to you about wine, buy some wine, can they?
Of course, but probably best. I wouldn't like to be seen to be promoting that.
No, but maybe what they could do is they could get a tip of a nice wine from you and then go and buy it cheaply down the supermarket.
We could certainly have a chat about it, yes.
Okay. Anyway, so why Conservative? Why the Tories rather than another of the three or four main political parties?
I would say I was brought up in a Conservative family. I always have sort of veered towards the right and the particularly on economic policies. I'm a firm believer in everybody should work hard, play hard, but work hard and earn money, and to reduce taxes as much as possible.
So you mean, when you say right-wing economic policies, you know, one of the things, if you're looking at the big picture, is that generally means private banking. Now, that has not worked, has it?
No, the banking sector went horribly wrong in the 90s and through into the early 21st century, and as we all know, we're still paying the price for it now.
So are you still a fan of the private banking sector?
I am, but with proper regulation.
But there isn't, is there? And the Conservatives are in the position right now where they could be putting proper regulation in. I mean, we don't know if Conservatives are going to be in any way in power after the next election. So isn't it time that he did put some proper regulation in time for the next government?
I would agree that at a central government level, that's absolutely right. There should be more control over these banks to ensure that what has happened and happened in 2008-09 can't be allowed to happen again.
But it's still happening, isn't it? I mean, surely we were just hearing this week about the massive bonuses going out to RBS, which we, the taxpayers, George Osborne, nominally, has got an 80-something percent share in RBS, and yet we're still, it seems, letting them have massive bonuses, even though the bank itself is making a multi-billion loss.
But the loss could have been a lot worse. And without the right people in these positions, and if they've got a contract that says they're going to earn X, Y, or Z bonus, then it needs to be paid. Otherwise, everybody will jump ship and go and work somewhere else.
One of the Telegraph is saying today that RBS has lost all of the £46 billion which it had from the taxpayer. I mean, they're still getting bonuses.
I haven't seen that report.
Well, I can just read it for you if you want. RBS has lost all the £46 billion pumped in by the taxpayer. Excluding these costs, RBS I mean, that's an incredible... It's the state rescued lender confirms total losses since bailout level with 2008 state bailout. Lost all the money invested in it by the taxpayer 6 years ago. When the lender came close to collapse, the bank has confirmed its total losses since bailout have now drawn level with the $46 billion which was pumped into it in 2008 in return for the 81% stake. RBS made a loss last year of $8.2 billion. Its sixth consecutive annual loss, taking its cumulative losses to 46. Because we very often hear Conservatives blaming previous Labour government, but I mean, surely it's now time for George Osborne to act at RBS, and at the very least to make sure that bankers are not being given bonuses for massive losses. In fact, losing all of the money that we put into the bank.
I would agree. I mean, I think the RBS situation, it was an absolute shambles. We all know the history of what went on in the past. I'm not blaming any administration, apart from the fact that there's a lack of regulation. And I would agree that the Chancellor should be bringing in regulation, particularly as the taxpayer owns the bank, or the majority thereof.
What are your thoughts about the idea of Gordon Brown stepping in back in 2008 and saying, look, rather than let this bank go bust, which might be the free market, that's what happens if a business goes bust, it goes bust. Do you think it was the right thing to do, to actually step in and to put public money into the bank, which it now seems we've lost?
I think... back then, because of the excesses that had been going on, I mean, the then government had to step in because of the impact on the retail economy, which obviously everybody could see was heading in the wrong direction, and the banks helped tip it over the edge, the whole economy over the edge. So I hadn't thought of it whether they're the right thing or the wrong thing. I don't know. I think probably the right thing for the people, but the wrong thing for the business.
Yeah, because a sort of free market principle would be, if something is bust, I'm sorry, but it's just going to go to the wall.
But I guess they were looking at the vast numbers of men and women on the street who had their borrowings or even their savings with the bank, and they couldn't afford to see that disappear.
Okay, Charles, well, you say you've got a business, hobby business in wine. I don't want to get too obsessed with it. I do like a drop of wine myself, I must admit.
Sure, but we can talk about it in a minute.
So what's your main business now?
I'm in property. So I have a property business and my wine business, and an alarming amount of time is spent at City Hall as well. Now that I've been elected.
Okay, so what sort of property does the business own? Is it just residential? What kind of stuff?
It's mixed-use development primarily, a bit of residential, a bit of commercial, and we're not just in Bristol, we do quite a bit up in the Midlands as well.
Okay, is it the sort of company that, because there's some, it seems, good property businesses and others not so good. Are you one of these businesses that hangs on to these big empty office buildings, leaves them empty for years on end?
No.
So what are you in the business? What's the name of the business?
Well, I have a number of brand names, if you like, but the main one is Alexander Hastings, and we develop conservation developments of small-scale courtyard developments in the Midlands, sometimes we include a bit of commercial space on those developments as well.
Well, it's in a way a bit of a privilege to have you here, because one of the things we talk about quite a lot is, why do we have all these empty offices? I mean, in the city centre, when you drive around, there's quite a lot of, you know, prime development, man, which is just rubble. Why is that?
Well, I agree with you. It's staggering that people can afford to keep offices empty nowadays, obviously with the empty business rate situation, meaning that buildings can't sit there for free anymore. I'm amazed that people can afford to leave them empty. We sadly, in the centre of Bristol in particular, we have too many buildings, in my view, that were rushed up in a hurry in the late 50s and 60s, and it's a great shame that they're allowed to be there, and because they're ugly, badly developed, poorly maintained, and all the rest of it. In fact, one of those such buildings, which I'm not saying it was poorly maintained, but the old Bridewell police station site, in my role on the Central Planning Committee for the council, we granted consent for a very exciting student accommodation block, which is going to be a very large 19 story tower block on that part of that Rupert Street, Nelson Street development only last week, and that's the sort of redevelopment that we need to see more of in city in the city, because Bristol's such a fantastic city, and it's whether we want to be seen as the eighth biggest city in the country and a city on the world stage, or whether we want to be seen as a sort of a depressing, less than positive looking, outward looking city for the future.
Well, it's good news about Bridewell. Fantastic news, in fact. Is it going to be keeping some of the character of the old building then?
No.
Completely flattening it?
Yep.
Okay, well, that's a pity as well, because that's quite an interesting building, isn't it? It's the old sort of civic fire station, police station building.
The fire station next door is staying, because that's, I forget who owns that now, but one of the youth organisations has taken that on and is doing great things down there in the old fire station. But the actual Bridewell police station, the one that had all the aerials on the top, that is being replaced by a very striking new glass-clad building. Hopefully, if the developer can afford to do it, of course.
Let's get back to this key issue, though, of how people who own multi-million pound buildings and slices of land right in the city centre can afford to keep it empty. I mean, you mentioned a business rate, and as I understand it, in the old days, if a building was empty, you got an exemption of some sort from paying business rates, and that was changed. So is that possibly why we've seen quite a few of these buildings, like the old clerical medical building? Almost as soon as it was vacant, it was flattened, and nothing's happened there since.
Well, I mean, absolutely, that's a real shame, because it's a prime site, as you say. But I think that is definitely part of it. They can't afford to have an existing building sitting there empty, because they have to pay the business rates, and that runs obviously to hundreds of thousands of pounds, if not more, a year.
But could they not get tenants in as some sort? I mean, maybe drop the rent, dare I say, a little bit.
Well, that you would have thought that would make sense. I'm not involved in that sector at all. I'm sure you could get people who would be able to speak to that much better.
I just thought I'd have the chance whilst we've got you in here, Charles. Of course, the other possibility is if you start to lower the rent, then the value of the building, someone might assess the value of the building to be less and less, in which case suddenly your business, it doesn't look so good on your business books, and it might not be viable. So that is a possibility. Anyway, old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, we'll just bring you in here. What are your thoughts about this business of the city centre? Because it's lovely to hear that Bridewell's getting developed, but it's quite a lot of businesses and office blocks in the centre, and also just sort of areas of rubble. It seems like the most imaginative thing that's happening in a lot of parts of the city is just people putting car parks on prime development land in the city centre.
Well, property is at the heart of the way Britain operates, and you know, the property market in Britain is rather unique. All sorts of vested interests are bound up in it. And, of course, we've got an overproduction of things like offices, because you can put that on your books as a performing asset. And, of course, as has just been discussed, at one stage you didn't have to pay business rates if you kept it empty. I mean, there is a real danger that we are developing a property bubble in this country now, as we have done in the past. It's nothing new here. And people are so used to the idea that this is a good thing that they can't even see that this is potentially another disaster in the making.
Charles, what do you thoughts about this idea? Is there a property bubble blowing up or not?
Well, I think we're all concerned that there may be again, and nobody wants to see a repeat of what happened in the recent past. But the British seem to have this isn't just a city thing, it's the whole country. An Englishman seems to have to own his own castle, and as long as people want to own their own houses, people will pay more and more to get what they want, and the same applies to commercial premises. And as Martin's just said, the commercial premises bubble is just as dangerous, in my opinion, as the residential bubble.
Right, well, biting our nails a little bit here, but is there anything that can be done about this, Martin, at all? Or is it just literally that the spare money that's flowing around in the investment sector is flowing into property and there's not a lot we can do about
it? Well, this is the problem, is the sort of property bubbles that Britain is prone to. It's partly to do with history. I mean, for example, owning your own home became, you didn't have to pay capital gains on the house price rises, and there was a policy of encouraging people to buy their own homes in the 1920s by Conservative governments, because it was seen to be people who own their own homes are more likely to vote Conservative. And of course, the creation of council housing in the 40s and the 50s created a sort of Labour bank of votes, and then selling them off undermined all of that. So property and politics are very, very embedded together in Britain. You know, you see house prices in places like Burnley haven't gone anywhere. But in places like Germany, the house prices have remained relatively stable since World War II, and that's normal for them, not normal for us.
Okay, as someone who's involved a bit in property, Charles, what about the Bristol Arena? What are your thoughts about that? Because that looks like that's going ahead now. We heard from the full meeting of the council. I imagine you were there.
I was, and I have to be honest, I'm entirely pro the arena. I think I know the mayor has hung his hat on it. But I think it's the sort of thing the eighth biggest city in the country should have. And I'm entirely pro it. And hopefully the development that will spring up around it and the investment that will go along with it can only help the city as a whole. And I would welcome the opportunity for Bristol to have exciting international acts and performers in Bristol rather than them all going to Cardiff or Birmingham.
What about the council taxpayers that won't be able to afford to go? I mean, we've got quite a lot of people in Bristol who are literally living on the breadline. Many of them have their benefits cut, this kind of thing. A lot of those people are simply not going to be able to access this, and yet their council tax is helping pay for it.
Well, yes, and obviously I'm sure we're going to talk about the council tax rise that was voted through at the council budget meeting. Obviously, you know, if there is an asset within a city and everybody can't enjoy it, then that's not ideal. But equally, everybody can prioritise, and the same applies as to whether these acts are going to Cardiff or going to Birmingham. If the acts are coming to Bristol and it creates investment in Bristol and greater income into the city, it can only help everybody.
I mean, surely we've already got the Colston Hall, we've got stadiums that can be used for these kinds of concerts.
Yes, but the business model that shows that an arena such as the one that is proposed will encourage the redevelopment of that part of the city. As we all know, that part of Bristol has been derelict for a very long time. That has to be good. And the whole investment in that part of the city must be a step in the right direction for the city as a whole.
Now, on to another story, and this man is a serial outsourcer. This is from the not entirely unbiased Bristol Anti-Cuts Alliance website by admin, whoever that is. Now, last month, apparently, a press release from the City Council announced Max Wide will join the Council in February as Strategic Director for Business Change, and rather modestly currently a company director in local government consulting firm Empower. Consulting in London, Max has a history of achieving major positive change in organisations and introducing more cost effectiveness. But Martin, what the anti-cuts people are saying, well, actually, this guy is a serial outsourcer.
Well, yes, I mean, he's got a track record of outsourcing services. So,
But I mean, if he can do that and make it cheaper, what's the problem?
Well, the question is, the existing services are there and people are working in them. But what Mayor Ferguson has got to decide is he going to keep things in-house or is he going to outsource them?
Well, so it seems pretty obvious he's going to outsource them.
Well, indeed. So when he said, I'm an independent, I have to ask, is he a left-wing independent or a right-wing independent? And it looks like he's turning into a right-wing independent. But then that's a policy that he will have to pursue if that's the one he wants to pursue. But, obviously, the people are going to question it.
Apparently he's been doing this kind of thing in Barnet, someone's posted on their website, saying all the signs are that Bristol is now facing the real possibility of a mass outsourcing privatisation of all council services. Whether the contract goes to BT, Capita, Serco or any of the other major players in the outsourcing market, the impact will be the same on every resident. Loss of democratic control, lower standards of service, big profits for the new service providers and the big consultancies who feast off these deals, Charles. Well, this is Bristol Anti-Cuts Alliance, which is probably as biased in one direction as the Bristol Post is in the other direction. What are your thoughts about having G4S, Serco, Capita, these kinds of companies running council services now?
Well, I think, bear in mind the cuts that we've had to make, I think we need to save money. And I think the budget that was passed last week showed that we had such substantial cuts we had to make, and fortunately with a minimum impact on services. But if we can save money by outsourcing services, as long as we can ensure that services and quality of services are not cut, then it's got to be a good thing.
Next story. Filton plane makers Airbus seeing revenues reach almost 50 billion. That's if they stay in Filton, and we do hope they do. We had a look at a map produced by Airbus from Toulouse a few weeks ago. I don't know if you've seen this, Charles, but it had all of the various Airbus plants around Europe, and Filton wasn't on there, which is a bit depressing. But I mean, maybe it was just an oversight. But there certainly are rumours circulating around that GKN are considering actually making active plans to move away from Filton, which would be a great pity. And Rolls-Royce is in all sorts of trouble with. Financially, with their share price going through the floor the other day. Airbus, the plane maker, which employs 4,000 people in Filton, today reported revenues, that was actually 3 days ago, reported 4 days ago, reported revenues up 5% to 59.3 billion euros. That's about 50 million billion pounds in 2013, with earnings before interest and taxes up to 24% to 2.7 billion euros. So it sounds good for Airbus, but what are your thoughts? Are they going to stay in Filton?
Well, I have to be honest, I don't know. I mean, I think obviously they are a fantastic success story, and their success in fighting the might of Boeing from the States is brilliant for Europe and for Britain, and for world travel. Seems to be every aeroplane you get on seems to be nowadays seems to be an Airbus, and it's fantastic. And together with the I believe they still manufacture their wings up in North Wales, I think I'm right in saying that, Tony. It's a fantastic success story for the Southwest. Obviously Filton does lie in South Gloucestershire, so sadly Bristol City Council doesn't receive direct finance, but obviously there's the indirect benefits that Bristol enjoys. And personally, I was disappointed to see that they've closed the airfield at Filton. I think that is a missed opportunity to. I know it's an old argument that's been you've probably discussed here many times before, but the fact that should Bristol Airport be situated at Filton, and whilst I welcome the development of new houses anywhere in the greater Bristol conurbation, I do think it's a shame that they're all being put in one place on the old airfield.
Well, the Bristol Post gave an opportunity today to Alison Devonshire from a group called BS10, which is up in that area, to have her say. And she says, our roads cannot cope with 8,000 new homes. There's an environmental man-made time bomb ticking on the borders of North Bristol. The reason is the plan to build these 8,000 new homes. As for Bristol as a European green capital, it would more likely be known as a smog city. The extra homes will offer a wide area, including West Beyond Trim, Henleys, Horfield and Locklees. Yet South Gloucestershire Council say the only pinch point will be Crow Lane roundabout. Where will the traffic go from there? Will it evaporate? She said, with the best will in the world, buses will not solve the problem. In fact, they too will be caught up in the traffic chaos. People will not want to get on their bikes or walk in the pollution of rush hour and simply look to commute other cities that in turn will drive business away. South Gloucestershire Council say they want more people to walk to work, but this will not happen. Martin, what are your thoughts about this? Because we've got big developments going on now. The airfield's closed, 8,000 homes appearing, and yet it seems not the infrastructure to cope with it.
Well, yes, I mean, we've been just discussing whether the airfield should close, and of course it's a decision for BAE, which is a private company, and they've made it entirely in terms of their own bottom line.
But it was originally public land, wasn't it?
Well, indeed. And we had Sir George White on here, whose grandfather gifted, I believe, the land to Bristol. And, of course, that was then taken as part of BAE when it was publicly owned. But RBA in the position to just sell this off for private profit without taking into account any industrial strategy. And, of course, they are. The question is, should they be able to? In Germany or Japan, they just laugh at you if you're suggesting such a thing. But this is Britain.
What about this set then, Charles? Because this is likely, according to Alison, to cause complete traffic chaos once these 8,000 homes are built without enough infrastructure. What are your thoughts about that principle?
Well, clearly, it's an issue that's going to have to be addressed. I'm pleased to say that the Sustainable Development and Transport Committee, in which I do sit, has literally organised a meeting for next month, the end of March. That was only put in our diaries this week, but to address precisely this issue, and I know it concerns a number of my colleagues in the northern half of the city, because how are all these people going to move about? And we all know that if you drive from the centre of the city out on the A4018 towards Filton, it's a very busy road at the best of times. So another 8,000 families living there, and people moving into work in the centre of the city is potentially a disaster.
Something is it simply South Gloucestershire Council granting planning permission and thinking, well, it'll, you know, if it causes trouble in Bristol, it's nothing to do with us?
Well, I wouldn't like to accuse our neighbours of that sort of attitude, but it does look to me as though they haven't thought about it enough, and despite the investment in Metrobus and other transport policies that are slowly coming through the system, it is undoubtedly not fully thought through at this stage. The capacity isn't there without a major road building programme.
Okay, off to Westminster now. Prime Minister's questions. They were back after their half term. I don't know if they call it that, but it was half term last week. And we start this week with Alan Beath, who's asking David Cameron about the whether church leaders should be listened to.
So, Alan Beath,
does the Prime Minister recognise that it's part of the job of church leaders to challenge governments about poverty? But will he discuss with them measures which can help people out of poverty, like the pupil premium, like cutting tax on low pay, like measures to help troubled families? Because there is nothing particularly moral about pouring even more borrowed money into systems which can trap people in poverty and trap them in dependence on state.
I think my rightful friend, who's a distinguished churchman himself, talks perfect sense. There is nothing moral about running up huge deficits, about out-of-control welfare bills, and if we don't deal with these problems, the whole country will be poorer. And I think we should listen to the words of George Carey, the former Archbishop of Canterbury, who said this: the churches should beware of the dangers of blithely defending a gargantuan welfare budget that every serious politician would cut as a matter of economic common sense. Well, I think serious politicians have to engage in this, and that should go for everybody.
Charles Lucas, Conservative councillor for Clifton, what are your thoughts about the intervention last week of church leaders really questioning the government's taking away welfare payments, these sort of things, and actually what's quite a large increase in child poverty? I mean, I'm looking at the BBC website. Yesterday, a story appeared on there: child poverty definition change put on hold. They're saying the government's unveiled a new child poverty strategy, but plans to change the way it's measured have been put on hold. Those changes, obviously, you won't be surprised if I tell you, the changes were going to actually make child poverty far less than it actually is at the moment, a new way of measuring it.
Obviously, it goes without saying that child poverty in a country like Britain should be zero, or as close to zero as is possible. The economic situation the government finds itself in is such that we haven't got a bottomless pit of money to throw around and address some of these chronic issues that need to be addressed. And with a prolonged recovery, I'm sure these issues can be addressed. But currently, there are so many priorities. I'm not saying that any one priority is more important than another, but these priorities have to be addressed in turn. And ultimately, we've got to get get rid of the deficit to start with, and then we can address other such issues.
I mean, children are suffering in the meantime, aren't they?
Well, regrettably, but everything that can be done, and my understanding is that the investment and social security money that's available the government is doing its best to alleviate this issue.
Martin?
Well, we just heard earlier on about RBS losing £43 million of our money. And we don't. The government doesn't seem to have any answer to that at all. And of course, the reason for that is that the philosophy is that RBS should eventually be back in the private sector, which is why you've got the high rollers working there and being paid big bonuses, because they're going back carrying out the same kind of mad bets they were doing when it was in the private sector. But of course, we've lost a massive amount of money on that. We've lost far more money on the banking
Martin,
system.
I just want to correct you. It's £46 billion.
Sorry, I'm out by a major factor. But when we're talking about getting the deficit down by squeezing down benefit payments at the bottom, it's just economic illiteracy, frankly. I mean, in Iceland, where their economy is doing rather nicely, one of the first things they did when they changed the government was they increased benefits for people, because of course you want to cushion the shock on the economy. And if you actually cut benefits for people on the bottom, it's actually macroeconomic silliness, because that means that the poorest people in the poorest communities then start a sort of downward spiral in those communities, so the shops close and then they're on benefits as well. Now, leaving that aside, I'd be interested to hear Charles's views on this, because I think there is an element of what the Linton Crosby and the Tory strategists are doing here, which is that they want to divert attention from things like RBS by talking about people on benefits. And what I sense from what you were saying is that you're not the sort of person that thinks that benefits are pointless or silly or we shouldn't have them. But there's an element within your party which seems to want to use scapegoating the poor as a kind of diversion tactic from the serious macroeconomic issues. And I think that the bishops speaking out about it, don't forget they are the people running the food banks, so they are actually have got some credibility here. But Alan Beath, of course, who's a Liberal Democrat supporter of the coalition, was giving David Cameron a very easy ball there.
Now, before you reply, Charles, I just want to put some figures on this from the BBC saying that the child poverty threshold is when family income is round about £256 a week and at the moment. And under those figures, next year, Labour are saying that that will mean that we've got 400,000 children in Britain in poverty.
The £256. Where did that figure? Who quoted that figure? That was on the BBC website.
Goodness no! I mean, no, there, this is well, this is the way the government currently measures.
Can I just clarify? The way you measure child poverty by 60 people, families with 60% of average, less than 60% of average income.
Child is said to be living in poverty if their household income is less than 60% of the average.
Yeah, so, in other words, if you've got a more unequal society, child poverty will rise, even if everybody's better off. Although, in fact, they're not better off.
But in fact, it's the opposite is the case, isn't it? I mean, just generally, yes. People are worse off because of the rising fuel prices and that sort of thing. Anyway, what are your thoughts about how to deal with this, Charles?
Well, first and foremost, I'm not an economist, so I would pretend to come up with a solution. But what I would say is that in the Conservative Party, we are very aware of the poorest elements of our community needing support and needing help. And I think the policies being shown by central government to minimise the impact on the poorest members of our community that we've seen, and indeed we heard about in Prime Minister's questions this week, shows that the party is, albeit in central government in London, but not in power in Bristol, we are doing the best that can be done in the current economic climate.
Well, to give credit, I mean, the typical energy bill has been reduced by £50, getting rid of these green taxes.
Well, that's one of many such policies that the Prime Minister and the Chancellor have brought in over recent weeks and months and during the time of this coalition government, and along with the Liberal Democrat coalition members. I genuinely believe that the economy is in a much better place than it was, and the pain that's been impacted upon the poorest members of our community is being minimised.
We heard earlier on about RBS. The bankers aren't our favourite people on this show, that's for sure. But this week there was also some news about HSBC, those people who were fined for money laundering over in the United States, although not, of course, fined in for that particular crime here in Britain. Anyway, they were touched on in Prime Minister's questions.
Mr. Speaker, this week HSBC announced staff bonuses of £2.3 billion. And 140% pay rise to its chief executive. when ordinary British families face a cost of living crisis and too many young people languish on the dole, isn't it time for this government to listen to Labour and tax bank bonuses to get our young people back to work?
Well, first of all, let me join the honourable gentleman in congratulating Team GB for the best medal performance since 1924 at a Winter Games. It was a huge honour to welcome them to Downing Street, where I had an explanation of the tasks of skeleton bobsleighing and indeed curling. But I think our congratulations go to everyone involved and all those who helped to train them. On the issue of banks, they are well down from the appalling situation that was left by the last Labour government. But what we need to see is the proper control of all forms of pay and bonuses. What I don't want to see, and what I think we'd get from the party opposite, is focusing only on bonuses, because, of course, you can claw back a bonus, you can't claw back pay. And we don't want to go back to the days of Fred Goodwin, where you could be paid well for an appalling performance.
Charles Lucas, Conservative councillor for Clifton. Yes, to be fair, the beginning of the question was actually about the Olympics, so sorry, that maybe I should have just got rid of that little reply from the Prime Minister. It sounded like he wasn't even thinking about asking the question. But what are your thoughts about the 140% pay rise for the chief executive of HSBC?
Well, I'm not obviously privy to the terms of his contract, but if the HSBC figures have hit certain thresholds, which I imagine is why is what has triggered this bonus, then in my opinion, it's what can you do about it? It's entirely due and it should be paid.
I mean, the Labour Party are talking about taxing these bankers' bonuses. I wonder if they were to decide to do that, well, they'd just find some other way of paying themselves, like share options, Martin.
Well, the fundamental problem is that the banking system is bankrupt, and it's been bankrupt since 2008, and it's bankrupt today. And the private banking system has been bailed out by the taxpayer all over the world, but particularly in Britain.
But it's not bankrupt, because it's been bailed out.
No, it's bankrupt. It's been bailed out to keep it afloat. And therefore, and don't forget, because we've got this fantasy that we're going back to having a private banking system, or that these chaps are all on the investment banking side, are carrying out all of these risky bets that they were doing previously. And of course, if they carry the risky bets out, then they can claim. Yeah,
if these, Martin, just a minute, because if these banks really are, as you say, bankrupt, why on earth are shareholders continuing to invest in them?
Because as long as quantitative easing continues, the game can carry on. And I think the problem is that the whole world economy now, with the City of London at its heart, is now totally dependent on money printing. And even with all of that, what we've got is a property boom in the US, in Britain, basically, and that is going to pop. And when it pops, it's not just going to property boom going to pop, the banks are insolvent. And ultimately, of course, you can see what's happening as they tapered QE the other week in the US. It started crises in Argentina, Thailand, Turkey, Ukraine is in, there's been a bank run in the Ukraine, as you might expect. And of course, all of this is ultimately going to wash over us like a Japanese tsunami. And of course, the political class as a whole, including the Labour Party, are still talking as if this is all right and we're just going back to normal as we were before the crisis. It's not going to happen.
Okay, back to Westminster again, and this time it's Luciana Borgia who's asking about why some of her constituents are having to eat out of supermarket skips.
Luciana Borgia.
Speaker, yesterday I met Billy. He's 24 years old and he's worked since he was 15 until he lost his job a year ago. Billy told me that he had to resort to going through supermarket skips to find out-of-date food just so he could eat. Prime Minister, Billy is desperate to work. Why won't the Prime Minister offer him a jobs guarantee rather than him having to scavenge in Iceland's bins for food?
Well, what we are doing for Billy and for thousands like him is offering jobs and hope that simply weren't there under the last Labour government. You know, honourable members opposite come here week after week to try and say that this country is somehow poorer or worse off under this government. Let me remind her what it was like in 2009. In 2009, there were a million more people in poverty, 500,000 more children in poverty, 150,000 more unemployed people, and 750,000 more people claiming benefit in 2009 than there were today. So yes, there's more to do, but we've got a proud record of giving people jobs and hope because we're sticking to a long-term economic plan.
Giving jobs and hope, says Prime Minister David Cameron, but it seems that Billy hasn't got a lot of hope of getting a job. He's having to get his food from Skip, Charles.
I'd like to start by responding to that, Tony, by saying that the Prime Minister's questions I watched had a lot of very interesting questions that came from one side of the House, and you seem to have picked up on all the questions that came from the other side of the House, but that's fine.
Well, to be fair, what I do is I'm not that interested in the questions that are coming from the ruling party. I want to get a bit of an exchange between
but
the two.
As the Prime Minister replied, there are a lot fewer billies now than there were when the Conservative and Liberal Democrat coalition came to power in 2010.
And, well, some would say there's a lot more, because there's a massive increase in food banks. People aren't going to these food banks because they've got plenty of food on the table.
Of course, there are areas where there are issues on all of these levels, but the economy is recovering. The economy is stronger than it was in 2010, and as the Prime Minister said, the current government is giving people hope for the future by generating jobs, particularly in the private sector, and with unemployment falling at the remarkable rate that it is, it's testament to that.
Martin?
The British economy is today still smaller than it was before the crisis in 2008. And if we have more people in work on paper, that implies that productivity per worker in Britain must have collapsed.
Well, all you're saying there, Martin, is from 2008 until the 2010 election, the economy was going down. Since then, it's been going up, and it just hasn't managed to get back up.
It's still not the same. It's still not as big as it was before the crisis.
That shows to me that the Labour Party, back between 2008 and 2010, were mismanaging the economy because it's going down. And then since the new government took over the coalition in 2010, it's been picking up again.
Well, I mean, in actual fact, there was growth in the economy when the coalition took over, and the austerity policy brought it to an end. Now, of course, we've decided that we can't reduce the deficit in one parliament, which is what Labour was saying all along. And, of course, we can subsidise with Help to Buy to get the housing market going. So all that's happening is we're getting a standard 1960s-style boomlet in order to get the Conservative government re-elected. But it's got nothing to do with the underlying health of the economy. The underlying health of the economy is still very, very poor. The economy is smaller today than it was before the crisis began. And that is unheard of in modern history. I mean, for example, the French and German and US economies are larger than they were before the crisis began. And, of course, the productivity per worker, this is the point I was going to make, has fallen through the floor, which implies that these jobs are low-wage, low-productivity jobs. Now, of course, they're all dependent on quantitative easing. Britain is quantitative easing. The United States is quantitative easing. The Eurozone isn't quantitative easing because the Germans won't allow it, which may, of course, cause a euro crisis. But underpinning all of this, in Britain as well, and it's particularly in the US, is money printing. Now, what they've started to do in the US is they've started to cut back on the money printing now. They're pumping $10 billion less a month into the financial system. The result of that has been to cause a crisis in the emerging markets, because basically all that hot money, which they can get for speculators can get for zero interest rates from the Federal Reserve, they then take in the carry trade to invest in places like Brazil. But it's hot money and it can come straight out again, and it has done. Underlying all of this is that the private banking system is bankrupt and is being propped up by the public sector. Now, in other words, the philosophy of the free market, the monetarist neoliberal revolution, came to an end in 2008. Once the governments of the world, including the US government under George Bush, decide to bail out the private sector, the free market philosophy is over. It's dead, but it won't lie down.
Okay, next story. Yahoo webcam images from millions of users have been intercepted by GCHQ. This is called the Optic Nerve Program, which is part of the revelations from the whistleblower. Some would call him a traitor and a criminal, even, Edward Snowden. These are bulk images. The 1.8 million users were targeted by the UK agency in a six-month period. Yahoo says a whole new level of violation of our users' privacy has been revealed here. Now, The Guardian, writing about this yesterday, say the system, eerily reminiscent of the telescreens evoked in George Orwell's 1984, was used for experiments in automated facial recognition to monitor GCHQ's existing targets and to discover new targets of interest. Such searches could not be used to try and find terror suspects or criminals making use of multiple anonymous user IDs. Charles, someone was joking, I saw on a web forum the other day, saying that actually GCHQ itself, if you look at it from the above, looks like a giant webcam pointing out into space. Are you going to be a little bit more careful when your computer is on as to whether you've switched your webcam on or not, yourself personally?
No, I don't think I am. I have nothing to hide.
Do you not mind you know, your living room being surveyed if your computer's switched on, or your lounge or whatever, through the webcam?
As I say, I've got nothing to hide, so I don't believe that anybody would be interested to see what's going on in my living room. Everybody is entitled to a degree of privacy, of course.
But your political opponents mightn't they?
I'd be very surprised.
But there's nothing to compromise you going on in your living room. We'll take your word for it. I feel intruding myself a little bit too much into your private life by saying that. But I mean, look, the serious point here is, you know, do you think it's okay for the GCHQ and other agencies to be having this ability to do mass surveillance of everybody and to keep mass databases of people's photographs, emails, text messages, and as GCHQ have actually been shown to be doing since Christmas, actually carrying out denial of service attacks, taking down websites?
Well, personally, I feel that if it would only bother you if you've got something to hide. Rightly or wrongly, I don't have a problem with this. I think national security is such that we need to allow the security services to do what they need to do to protect the people of this country.
So should they not go in front of a judge and say, we suspect this person of something and we would like a warrant to put them under surveillance?
I believe that if they want to go beyond a general level of surveillance, then yes, they should get authority from whichever power that it is required.
Peeping into your home is about as cheeky type of surveillance as there can be, surely?
Yes, we accept that. I'd be very, very surprised. Obviously, I've seen what's in the press on this, but we don't know the actual details. And
well, we know quite a lot now because of the these revelations from Edward Snowden. I mean, maybe people suspected this kind of thing was going on before, but now we've got it all in black and white. I mean, it's actually, if you look at the article, there's a whole load of screenshots of the presentations that were being given at the NSA and GCHQ about what the capabilities were and what they were actually up to. I mean, you know, 1.8 million user accounts have been hacked.
I stand by what I said already, and that is that if you've got nothing to hide, then there's nothing to worry about.
Martin?
Well, I mean, in the US Constitution, there are specific, when it was written in the 18th century, specific protections against people having their personal lives pried into unless there was a legal basis, in other words, a warrant. And that's the basis in this country as well. So what appears to be happening here is that GCHQ are operating entirely outside the law. Now, if things are outside the law, then they're illegal. And that means the people who gave orders for them, a bit like drone strikes, as has been pointed out, there's no legal basis for zapping people in foreign countries you don't like, none at all. Ultimately, of course, there is going to be a rule of law, and many of the people in our intelligence services, who are in fact up to their eyeballs in terrorism in places like Syria, are going to be put in front of judges and sent to prison. And that's why I'm not happy for these people to be spying on us, because in actual fact, they're out of control. There's no political control over what they do. Their excuses about national security are laughable in the circumstances, when we know that NATO intelligence services have a track record, for example, of supporting Islamist terrorism in the 1980s during the good old days of Margaret Thatcher, when MI6 was the lead agency for the international brigades sent to Afghanistan. I don't trust them. And because I don't trust them, I expect them to be under a rule of law, basically that judges decide whether people are to be targeted for things like this, and they're way beyond their remit.
You couldn't get two more opposing views, I don't think, could you, folks? Anyway, back to Westminster now, and this is a look at this rather incredible idea that if people want to appeal against getting their money cut off by ATOS, their benefits, they will have to pay for an appeal.
Michael Connerty.
Could the Prime Minister focus on the fact that ATOS now want to give up their contract for the work capability test? Is it not time to change the test back to one based upon the medical evidence of the consultants of those who are applying, when 158,000 appeals are upheld? Surely it's time for him also to rescind his decision to charge people for appeals.
Well, first of all, I hope it's not too uncharitable to point out that the Atos contract was actually awarded by the last Labour government. And of course, we are now discussing and debating with the company how this should be taken forward. But the fact is, we do need in this country a way of determining whether people are fit for work or not. And when it comes also to the issue of sanctions in our benefit system, frankly, it is right that people who are offered a job and don't take a job do now face a sanction. And I think that will be the choice at the next election. One party in favour of hard-working people, another party obsessed by bigger and bigger benefits.
Well, Charles, it's not just people who are offered jobs that get sanctioned. It's all sorts of people that are being sanctioned. What are your thoughts about this principle, though? The DWP document, which was leaked, I think, to The Guardian and The Independent, they're saying now that if someone wants to appeal the decision to cut off their benefits, then they should have to pay for that appeal.
Well, obviously, you know, as we just heard in that clip, the terms of that contract are historic, and we are all stuck underneath that contract at the moment, and as and when a new contract is negotiated, I'm sure these issues can be addressed. But I think the fact that, as I've alluded to already, I am entirely supportive of elements of our community and the people of this country who need it receiving whatever benefits they do need. But we cannot have a situation with such a massive budget deficit where we people are able to claim benefit who are perfectly capable of working, who for whatever reason choose not to. And I'm afraid in this day and age that is just wrong.
But there just aren't enough jobs to go around, surely. I mean, we've just heard today, this is the Oxford Mail, about a vulnerable and fragile man who was starved to death 4 months after his benefits were stopped, and he was left with just £40 a week to survive on, including his rent. Martin, just very quickly.
Well, I think it's. I'm glad to hear that Charles wants to help the poor, but of course the poor don't feel it like that. And I think also the idea that you're going to get the deficit down by bullying these people around is laughable when we're spending £45 billion bailing out RBS. It's a joke.
Yeah, so Charles, I mean, would you agree that there are some people who actually cannot find work? I mean, there is not enough jobs for everybody to go around, quite clearly. There's around about five people for every job that's available. So four of those people are going to need to claim benefits. We've just heard about the vulnerable and fragile man who's been starved to death in Oxford because his benefits were cut off.
Well, I hadn't heard about the gentleman in Oxford. What I would say, though, is that the deficit that, and I've had to say this before, but the deficit that the coalition government inherited was such that we now are, the country is in a better place, the economy is recovering, and with there will be more jobs are being created in the private sector with every week that passes.
Fingers crossed. Okay. Thanks very much. That was Conservative Councillor for Clifton, Charles Lucas, this week's guest. After the Murdoch news, the battle for Ukraine began in earnest last Friday. We discuss it much more after the news.
Is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 6, a woman who murdered three men, dumped their bodies in ditches and then tried to kill two others will spend the rest of her days in prison. A judge described 31-year-old Joanne Dennehy as cruel, calculating and selfish. Detective Chief Inspector Martin Brunning from Cambridgeshire Police spoke outside the Old Bailey.
We saw what sort of person Joanne Dennehy is.